And good morning, everybody. You're listening to the Mighty 690 KGGF. And as promised, joining us on the phone this morning is the Kansas Attorney General, Derek Schmidt. And Mr. Schmidt, good morning. How are you doing today, sir?
I'm well. Good morning, Kyle.
Well, sir, a few things to talk about. Obviously, the elephant in the room, obviously, was the Electoral College votes were cast yesterday. But Kansas, all the votes went to, of course, Donald Trump. And I'm assuming that went pretty smoothly yesterday here in the state of Kansas.
Yeah, it did. And it appears to have gone fairly smoothly in states around the country. But for Kansas, no surprises. It was actually, I thought, rather interesting. I went and pulled up some of the both public news coverage and other records from the last time the Electoral College met in Kansas 4 years ago. And it looks as if things this time were actually quite quiet. There were a number of reports from 4 years ago, of course, when President Trump beat Hillary Clinton, talking to the electors about receiving tens of thousands of calls and emails clogging their work email boxes, because of course they're all private citizens when they're not acting as electors, making it impossible for them to actually do their day jobs. So even though things seem a little noisy now, it appears to have been a bit calmer than it was 4 years ago.
So, again, the Electoral College was done yesterday all across the country. Pretty quiet, though, getting that done. But before that happened yesterday, of course, the state of Texas and 17 other states, I do believe, joined in a lawsuit to the Supreme Court to try to try to find some relief on the possible voter fraud. Of course, the U.S. Supreme Court declined to hear the lawsuit. And I just kind of want to get your thoughts on that, sir.
Well, you know, look, somehow in the last 4 years, we've managed on both sides to personalize presidential elections in a way that I think is not healthy. You've got folks that think President Trump can do no wrong, and you have many other folks who think that President Trump can do no right, and the common denominator is that for both of those sort of strident factions, it's about President Trump. And from my vantage point, at least, it's not about this president or any individual. It's about the process by which we choose presidents together in this country. We waded into the Texas suit because we asked the Supreme Court a question a month ago, right after the presidential election, not about facts, but about constitutional law. What does the U.S. Constitution's Electoral Clause mean when it says that state legislatures, and that's what the federal Constitution says, legislatures determine the times, places, and manner of federal elections in their state? And the reason the issue arose is that in some states, Pennsylvania in particular this time, the legislature said to do one thing, specifically count mail-in ballots by the close of business on election day. They have to be received by the close of business on election day. Well, they don't count if they come in on Wednesday or Thursday or Friday. That's what the law in Pennsylvania says. There's no dispute that that's what it says. But despite that, the Pennsylvania state courts, ultimately their state Supreme Court, said, you know, because of the pandemic, we're going to discount the law the legislature enacted, and we're going to order a different set of rules. We're going to allow ballots to be counted until Friday if they come in by mail by Friday. Now, there's nothing inherently wrong with allowing ballots to be counted if they come in by mail after Election Day. Kansas does that. But the difference is Kansas does it because we had debate and enactment of law by our legislature that said that's what the rule will be here. In Pennsylvania, their legislature said the rule is you got to have them in by Election Day, and the courts ordered something different. So I'd like an answer to the question of whether the federal Constitution that orders legislatures to set the time, place, and manner of elections allows other non-legislative actors to change the rules, especially at the last minute. And if we don't get that answer now, we're unlikely to have it in 4 years at the next presidential election, because these sorts of disputes only arise in the context of a presidential election that happens every 4 years. So we have a real interest in that. We asked the court to answer the question. They've sat on that request now for over a month. It's still pending. It's been there for almost 5 weeks, not quite. And so we joined with Texas to try once again a different avenue to get the court to answer the question. Obviously, they declined, and you know, we'll see where we go. But we have a fairly complicated process in this country of choosing our chief executive. It's not a straightforward popular vote. We use the Electoral College. That's constitutionally required. There's a timeline built in, and you know, the process had to play itself out. It now has, with the vote of the Electoral College yesterday.
Yeah, and then, like I said, the votes were cast yesterday, and then the actual count, I do believe, is on January 6th, where the vice president actually counts out the votes, and then I actually think that's when it's actually finalized. Is that correct?
Congress convenes on January 6th to formally count the votes of the Electoral College. There have been instances where Congress, on that date, has tried to alter the count that occurred on the day of the actual vote of the Electoral College. The most recent time that that happened was in 2004, when President George W. Bush was reelected. You may recall from history that that was a relatively close election, and there were disputes in the state of Ohio about the procedure that that state used to run its presidential election. I actually went back and reread this past week U.S. House Judiciary Minority Staff, the Democrat staff for the U.S. House Judiciary Committee, actually compiled a report prior to the congressional counting of the electoral votes that year. And it's available on the internet. You can Google it. It's really interesting reading because although the factual allegations are a bit different, it sounds an awfully lot like the same types of complaints that many of President Trump's supporters have this year. Except that year, it was John Kerry's supporters, of course, they lost the election. They had the same types of grievances and ultimately went to the Congress on January 6th. And 31 members of the U.S. House of Representatives, all Democrats in that case, 31 members voted to throw out the Ohio electoral votes on the basis that they were, as you might say now, fraudulently cast. They were cast in a manner that was inconsistent with law. And, of course, that would have had the effect that they prevailed of shifting the outcome of the election from George Bush to John Kerry. So, you know, this is not new to have this sort of dispute and sort of long-standing fights among Americans over how the system works right to the end. You know, I'm hopeful that this time it'll actually be truncated and that folks will start to accept the finality, particularly right after the vote is cast on January 6th. You may recall, you know, for President Trump, there was a large faction of Americans who never did accept the legitimacy of the 2016 election. And it wasn't just, you know, political complaining and the resist bumper stickers and all that sort of thing. It wasn't just political expression. For 3 years, they worked with, in some cases, government officials to try to undermine the legitimacy of the Trump presidency. And that resulted ultimately in the attempt to impeach the president, remove him from office 3 years into his presidency, in part over conduct that had been disputed since the election 3 years earlier. So I really hope we can avoid that sort of, I think, unhealthy, lingering dispute about election results this time.
Yeah, absolutely on that. Well, hopefully we can just kind of move on and try to pull together as a country. That's definitely would be the best. A few other things that are going on. You have joined the state of Kansas has joined a multi-state lawsuit seeking to end Facebook's illegal monopoly, which they do have quite a large share of social media, of course, with obviously Facebook, Instagram, WhatsApp, a lot of the different apps that they currently own, and they just keep buying more apps, smaller apps. And just again, if you can kind of explain to our listeners what this entails.
Yeah, you know, it's one of those funny things. Timing is everything in life, and sometimes you just don't have it. We've worked for well over a year, bipartisan effort to investigate Facebook for what we believe is an unlawful, under federal antitrust law, an unlawful strategy to prevent competition by essentially buying up all of their competitors in sort of a predatory manner before they can actually become real competitors. And, you know, last week we joined in filing a lawsuit challenging that conduct. It was I was part of the Republican leadership team. My counterpart in New York, Tish James, led it on the Democrat side. You know, Tish is a very liberal New York Democrat. I'm a relatively conservative Kansas Republican, and you know, we worked together, got 46 states total to join us, plus the D.C. Attorney General in Guam. So, I mean, it was a pretty remarkable year-long effort, and almost nobody noticed because it wound up getting filed within 24 hours of the Texas lawsuit over election and everybody wants to talk about that. So sometimes you just don't have good timing. But we do think it's a serious issue. We've been looking more broadly in a bipartisan manner at the role of big tech more generally in managing information that goes to the American public. There's certainly nothing wrong with being big, and there's nothing wrong with conveying information, and there's nothing wrong with expressing a point of view. But when you are so big because you violate antitrust law to get that big, and then you use that exclusive monopolization power in the marketplace to shape the message that influences public discourse on, you know, everything from what toothpaste to buy to who ought to be president of the United States, we think that that's exactly the type of conduct that federal antitrust law was designed to limit, just as it limited the oil companies and to a lesser extent the steel companies in the 19th century, it limits the tech companies in the 21st. And so we started down that road, and you know, we'll see what the courts ultimately say, but I think the fact that there is such very strong bipartisan support for this suggests that it is a widely shared concern.
Absolutely, because it just seems like there. It seems like everything that starts up, they seem to buy it, and their reach just keeps getting wider and wider. So it seems like Facebook pretty much owns almost all the social media sites. There's just a few still out there they do not own. Now, also, one of the last things I do want to discuss with you about is you have recently named a Solicitor General and the Deputy for Legal Opinions you appointed Brett Lyle to serve as the Kansas Solicitor General, and Sarah Shipman to serve as the Deputy Attorney General for the Legal Opinions and Government Counsel Division.
Yeah, we had the need for a new Solicitor General who is our Chief Appellate Attorney at the Attorney General's office. Our last one, Toby Krause, a terrific fellow, but he recently became a federal judge. He was appointed a federal judge in Kansas by President Trump, confirmed by the U.S. Senate, and recently sworn in. So obviously we had a vacancy, and I was very pleased to be able to appoint the fellow who's been sort of our number two in the solicitor's office on the civil side, a fellow named Brant Lau, terrific litigator, long experienced lawyer, a lot of experience in federal court litigation, and I think he's going to do a very good job for the state in picking up the ball and running with it. And then we had another division that also had a vacancy in its leadership within the AG's office this week. Unfortunately, we had a terrific woman leading our government counsel and legal opinions division, a woman named Athena Andea, and she simply hit eligibility for retirement and decided to retire. So we're happy for her, but sorry for us. And again, I was fortunate we had some very good talent within the office, and Sarah Shipman that we've been able to promote, and I think Sarah will do a great job. She's a former Secretary of Administration for the State Department of Administration, and before that was General Counsel for that department. So she has a lot of experience in state government operations and the sort of legal workings of state government, and I think she'll be a real asset for the state going forward.
All right. So, again, lots of news out there, and I appreciate you spending a few minutes of your time with us today, sir. And we enjoy talking to you every month, and we'll talk to you again next month about probably a whole new set of issues.
Sounds very good, and I hope everybody has a Merry Christmas. I'll take care.
All right. You have a very Merry Christmas as well, too, sir. All right, that is Attorney General Derek Schmidt for the state of Kansas. We enjoy talking to him every month, and we'll talk to him again in January on January 19th. So that is the next time we will talk to the Attorney General. Lots of great information there for you. And what we're going to do, we're going to throw that up on our website, the interview up on our website, kggfradio.com, and you can listen to the entire thing in its entirety. We're going to go ahead and take a break, though. When we come back, we'll have news at the top of the hour. You're listening to the Mighty 690 KGGF.